Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 84, section 1, which is old single column, page 931. Okay, yes, section 1, we just got into the paper. We read the preface and talked about the basic contextualizing that they were giving us for this paper, and recall that as you look to the title of the first section, you see we're kind of back to the primitive state. So it's like, looks like we're going to make another pass through the evolutionary spectrum here. What's the key thing that we're going to keep an eye out for this time? And it's the home. We got, remember the first paper, we got a lot about kind of just the basic dynamics of folkways that resulted from the mating phenomenon, you know, the basic biologic phenomenon. In the second paper, we brought in more formally the institution of marriage and humans beginning to lift themselves above just what happens unconsciously and totally naturally. And now even more so, we're moving into that territory that doesn't happen without some conscious intervention. Begins small, but conscious intervention nonetheless of reflective, the results of reflective thinking, the products of reflective thinking. Earnestly considering how some of these budding institutions fit into a bigger picture. And remember, they mentioned that in the preface, that when you get to the home, you very much are transcending something that's merely just there with the individuals or even the couple of individuals. Of their immediate concern, you're getting into the very foundation of civilization itself and all of the societal machinery of civilization is in play and is predicated on this foundational element. Remember that one amazing statement there at the end of the first paragraph of the preface when they said, "And home building should be the center and essence of all educational effort." Think about how academics in their ivory towers can definitely get way off into abstract spaces, far removed, from even practicality, let alone the foundation, in this very direct sense of the machinery of civilization, the home. And so, for them to have that challenge is like, okay, we're studying abstract mathematics, but why ultimately? Is it just for our own self-gratification? Is just an institution of self-gratification? It has nothing to do with self-maintenance or self-perpetuation. It's just a little game that a handful of us like to play with ourselves. Toss it back and forth around the world, in these cloistered groups, or what? I mean, there's other spots in the book where they remind that everyone, be they scientist or religionist or whatnot, need to weigh their worth against their usefulness to society, right? And not have that tendency to just really find a way, a sophisticated way to be selfish. and have others convinced that you're not being selfish. I mean, this is somehow for the greater good, and it's very lofty things, you know, when it really isn't. It just produces journal articles that no one reads. That very strong appeal that they made, that the spiritual idealism and the material pragmatism are there. Very definitively now are getting a super additive cosmic construct that encompasses the wholeness of civilization, so that it can be a foundational element for the wholeness of that civilization.
So this is key, then, if this book's about civilization.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely key.
Yeah, like I think I emphasized it. You know, since I stress that all the time. If that's what it's fundamentally about, is a civilizational emergency, no wonder they separated this matter in their own papers. They didn't just blend it into the civilizational papers. It needs to be held out because it's the fundamental element. Period. Okay, so let's see how they take us back to the horde here again and remind us of this process, but now thinking about not just marriage, but the home.
Section 1, Primitive Pair Associations. Marriage was not founded on sex relations. They were incidental thereto. Marriage was not needed by primitive man, who indulged his sex appetite freely without encumbering himself with the responsibilities of wife, children, and home.
Okay. So the first thing you notice there is playing off of that comment. When they said primitive man, before you read any further, you're thinking, oh, they're probably speaking generally, you know, that's the general word man. No, that's the specific word man in contrast to women. Men in contrast to women. And we're going to see very much that specific focus, because the tension between men and women have a lot to do with the integrity of the home. That tension can be overcome for a fleeting moment of passion and procreation is had. But the home's a different matter. Somehow men and women have to find a way to deal with their tensions if there's going to be the maintenance of a home, not to mention the equality to that home, and not just the quantity of it. So you see that right up front there. And so they're reminding you between the lines, and you'll see they'll begin to say it all the more directly. There is no paternal instinct. All right, we're gonna re-engage that. There is lots and lots of maternal instinct, and they're gonna speak to that. But right between the lines, very first paragraph. Make sure that you aren't still carrying that delusion forward, that somehow there's some paternal instinct, as they're stressing right there. He indulges sex appetite freely. There's no instinct that's getting in the way and complicating the matter. It's not that he's overruling something and in that way, insidiously not encumbering himself with the responsibilities. There's no instinct, that gives you some notion of, I have a responsibility here, like a woman almost inescapably has with her maternal instinct.
So it's all volitional for a man.
Yeah, if it's not that individuated and hence really genuinely volitional, it is imposed upon him by the mores. Yeah. Thou shalt, XYZ, under penalty of death by, the society. you know, or whatever. Something has to, you know, put the fear of God in the guy to make this happen, you know, as it were, right?
Not a speck of altruism to be seen.
Yeah, so... right, so that's the launch. You know, it's not wife, not children, not home, not nothing.
Okay.
All right. All right. So what else do they say here?
Woman, because of physical and emotional attachment to her offspring, is dependent on cooperation with the male, and this urges her into the sheltering protection of marriage. But no direct biologic urge led man into marriage, much less held him in. It was not love that made marriage attractive to man, but food hunger, which first attracted savage man to woman and the primitive shelter shared by her children.
Right, so, I mean, it's got to be one of the two foundational hungers. It's not sex hunger, it's got to be food hunger. I mean, because we're talking at the very primitive level, there's only two options. It's got to be, you know, if it isn't one of those two things, it's not going to happen. You know, primitive man only thought when he was hungry. Yeah. Okay. If it's not A or B, it's not happening in primitive man.
He's probably hungry right after the first
episode. Okay, so, you know, that fact that she has a very helpless infant that needs shelter from the elements, and she's going to do her best to, you know, find an overhang in the rocks, or, you know, kludge something together with twigs or something, try to make some sort of crude shelter to try to protect her cherished baby from the elements. And she's hungry, and and the baby's eating, and that's making her all the more hungry, and you know, so she's going to have something, you know, to eat. And the guy is standing out in the freezing cold, and thinking, well, you know, the food thing, and you know, as long as I've got the food, it's a little bit of shelter isn't bad either, you know, as long as no one's looking, you know, so that I, you know, affects my manhood, you know, in the group here. But, right, I mean, it's, you know, that's how it got started. It, like they're saying, it's not some sort of idealized love, quote unquote, thing. It's not even, you know, just the sex hunger issue itself. That's just, yeah, one moment and then that's done. And it's like, well, what about the whole issue with, he knows that this is going to lead to children. Well, we're going to get to that. It's like, does he? right, that's the next paragraph here. Okay, so let's see, anything else there? You see how it's not between the lines now, but no direct biologic urge, because there is none. Period. All right. And
is it that way for some reason?
I mean, it's you know, you, that kind of quickly becomes apparent when the two are working together and they start to kind of get this. It's like, oh, well, someone has to be, has to have his hands free, because the attacks from other humans and animals are coming from every direction. The saber-toothed tiger in the winter is very hungry. he has to be able to just completely turn his back on all of that. You know, he can't be trying to keep one eye on a kid, or the saber-toothed tiger is, you know, got his head in his mouth. There has to be someone who can be just fixated on what's coming at, you know, him. And then eventually he sees to it that the wife and children are behind him. And so he's not just protecting himself, but he's protecting this new concept that he's adopted of a family. And he's drawn to it because he has a loyalty instinct. And he kind of is delighted that he can apply it there. You know, it wasn't immediate, but it's like, well, now that you bring it up, you know, I could be loyal to this. You know, in the same way I'm loyal to the tribe or whether we'll fight to the death or, you know, it brings this new opportunity for loyalty into play. You know, and, you know, in a very rudimentary sense, it really doesn't matter what he's loyal to. It's just delightful to be loyal. Okay? And you want to encourage him not to be loyal to his baser, selfish instincts, because that can be just as delightful. Right? Like I said, it's kind of indiscriminate loyalty impulse. Okay? All right. Okay, let's see. Anything else there? No. Okay, keep going.
Marriage was not even brought about by the conscious realization of the obligations of sex relations. Primitive man comprehended no connection between sex indulgence and the subsequent birth of a child. It was once universally believed that a virgin could become pregnant. The savage early conceived the idea that babies were made in spirit land. Pregnancy was believed to be the result of a woman's being entered by a spirit, an evolving ghost. Both diet and the evil eye were also believed to be capable of causing pregnancy in a virgin or unmarried woman, while later beliefs connected the beginnings of life with the breath and with sunlight.
Okay, so, you know, in modern times, we've tried to get young gals to be very fearful of being out in the sun for fear of melanoma. There was a different issue in play back in the day. Whatever you do, don't go out in the sunlight. but again, you know, you can, it's like, well, how could they think that? Remember, again, I mean, like they were just indicating, they think it's some sort of a, you know, a mystical spirit engaging phenomenon. I mean, you know, the tribe may be worshiping that big bright orb in the sky. You know, it's sort of the spirit. So, right, the rays coming down from the spirit, you know, you could certainly rationalize, might, you know, make something happen. And then we all know about how the breath was, you know, the first sort of mystical concept that people latched onto. And we still have the breath of life in our, you know, in our language because of it. So anything, see, that they're thinking is quote-unquote spiritual, mystical, you know, water, you know, I mean, there's a reason why we baptize with water, right? Again, that's all of those things that you think might bring spirit into contact with her. But notice that they did add that one little bit, that it kind of had to get to the point where you didn't just have ghosts, the concept of ghosts. You had to get a little bit farther down the road where they're beginning to get a two-tier concept, that there's an immediacy after death where the person's a ghost and then they evolve into a spirit. Because they, you know, see, so they had some sense that it had to be quite removed from anything immediate so it could be completely mysterious how it is that she becomes pregnant. It was just, it's like, well, if it was just a ghost, I'm thinking about that in a pretty immediate sense. There would have to be like some very immediate contact, and I'm not, you know, seeing that. You know, so it's like, you know, if you're going to have something as ethereal as breath or sunlight or something like that. See, you know, so they aren't totally just making this stuff up, you know, out of thin air. I mean, they have a little bit of a logic to what they're doing because we're all humans. And no matter how primitive, there'll be some little bit of the first cosmic intuition, you know, and some causality, some foundational logic, you know, that you're trying to bring into the rationalization scheme. Let's see here. Oh, and did you notice the pun in there? The savage man early conceived the idea that babies were made in spirit land. the revelators never miss an opportunity.
It's nice that they didn't understand the physics, because that would have interfered, most likely.
And the thing that you want to pause and just consider, again, they're telling you what is your natural state. And if humans sort of fall all the way back and kind of just are nothing but their natural mentality, it doesn't matter that it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of years hence from what we're talking about here, all humans will completely be clueless again about where babies come from. I mean, you know, in just a very short span of time, you could have humans living on this planet, you know, if the darkness gets that extensive, that are utterly oblivious again. That's the way the natural estate. You can even hear some stories sometimes about, in the not so distant past, where you have very, isolated totalitarian regimes, and where they keep all the people very ignorant and they're clueless about where babies come from. They'll go into the doctor and say, you know, I don't know what's going on. We sleep together every night, but she's not getting pregnant. It's like, well, are you having sex? What? I thought all we had to do is just be in the same bed. You know, I mean, it seems impossible to believe, but it's a lot like that jealousy comment. It's so hard for us to believe that that's not biologic. See, you know, they're just reminding you of some of these things that your ignorance naturally is stunning. Okay, so don't be surprised if there's still some blind spots in your mentality.
Yeah. I can see a lot of people giving their response. Well, we've got the spirit of truth. That can't happen anymore. We've got the thought adjusters, universal bestowal of knowledge. That's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, they forget that, you know, the book tells them point blank that those things are almost wholly dependent upon you doing the first step of engaging the Holy Spirit. Those ministries can't relate to you except on the predicate of you taking delight in cultivating, having a reflective mind. Spirit of Truth just sitting there twiddling its thumbs. Without you leaning in its direction. So, yeah, it's the stories I was alluding to are post-Pentecost, okay? Right. They're within the last 100 years. Yeah, I mean, like I was saying, it's just, none of us want to be delusional about our natural estate, just how limited it is, and so how far we could fall if we stop imposing an unnatural understanding. You know, if we all just go back to the natural, it'll be very, very ignorant state of affairs. Was there another
doctor question? Says, so did you guys let some light in the window?
Yeah, right. Yeah. See, and that's the amazing thing about that story I'm thinking of is, you know, it isn't in this hyper superstitious state like that. We're talking about a doctor, you know, who's, you know, treating cancer and stuff like that, okay? You know, who's got patients coming in that don't know where babies come from. You know, and they're not coming out of the jungles of New Guinea or something either. All right, so let's see. Anything else there? Just, you know, see, again, they're I just want to stress this. It was once universally believed that a virgin could become pregnant. Again, it's not just some isolated pocket of ignorance. It is the cross-the-board natural state for us to be clueless. You know, and we don't want to, none of us should have any illusions otherwise. All right, let's see. The diet and the evil eye, you know. So you see that even way, way back when, people had a tendency to turn diet into a evolutionary religious, like, you know, an ism-like concept. You know, it's not just in recent times that we can get all amped up about diet and have various modes of dietism. And it's like, well, why? Why would it be so kind of inescapable? You know, so it goes back all the way to the most ancient of times. Again, what did we just remind ourselves of? There's these two foundational hungers, food hunger and sex hunger. And mankind, in his evolutionary religious thinking, always puts a lot of mystical weight on the most ancient, the most foundational of things. We all know, you know, peoples that have, you know, elaborated all kinds of ways about sex and in relationship to religion. But food too, see, you know, in the same mode. So, you know, there's just something deeply mystical about, I stick this stuff in this hole in my face and I don't die, you know, because you don't have no idea why you're living in the first place and all this. So, see, it's all very mysterious and spiritual, okay? Quote unquote. All right, let's keep going here.
Many early peoples associated ghosts with the sea. Hence, virgins were greatly restricted in their bathing practices. Young women were far more afraid of bathing in the sea at high tide than of having sex relations. Deformed or premature babies were regarded as the young of animals which had found their way into a woman's body as a result of careless bathing or through malevolent spirit activity. Savages, of course, thought nothing of strangling such offspring at birth.
Okay, so actually there's the full-on with the magical water stuff, and you want to take great care when you bathe, you know, just all these fears, you know, you can just imagine, you know, how just petrified with fear everyone is, you know, when they're so ignorant of material physical causality. And just how oblivious, you know, thought nothing of having sex with everything that moved, but, you know, would never bathe. I'll remind you, that's not those people way back then. That's you underneath your civilized nature that was taught on top of that foundation. That's every one of us, down underneath all of us. That's the way your basic mind functions. With all of that superstition and ignorance and natural tendencies to be fascinated by water and fire and sun and whatnot. Yeah. Yep.
Chris, do you think it could have been planned, or the life carriers, whoever, knew this tendency and they thought it was probably good because man would not focus too much self-reflection on the sex act, or else they, you know, pull away from that, you know, and not have offspring.
Right.
So it's a way to get his mind, he's not using his conscious mind to have these sex relations, he's using his conscious mind towards these other fears.
Yeah. I mean, great point, because like we pointed out, I mean, how many things, now that we are more sophisticated, We come up with all kinds of reasons ideological reasons that we think should overrule our mating instinct. You know, it's like, I really shouldn't mate for X and Y, Z reason, you know? You're very correct. The species needs to be ongoing. And so you can't have very primitive people with their heads filled with all sorts of tangential notions. Yeah.
Do you think it was okay to bathe at low tide?
You could have been a shaman and made that argument that it was okay at low tide. lest the village become very smelly.
A friend of mine went up, he was here in Denver, and he went up to Minnesota in, I think, 2007 for a year and a half to work at a shelter there. And he said that the Somali Muslim women would crank out babies and just say, that was his words, and say, Allah will provide.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of brings in, we haven't really gotten to those sorts of elements, but when you start to bring religion in, we all know that can completely cause you to overrule any pragmatic thoughts about procreation. You just see yourself as a helpless victim of God's infinite demands. Right? I mean, technically, he wants you to have an infinite number of babies, and so you're going to give it your best shot, from the moment that you reach puberty until you can't do it anymore for whatever reason. They're going to mention that kind of issue here in just a little bit. About what happens when you start getting ideology in play a little bit more. But obviously, we don't have a lot of ideology when you're all thinking all the way back at the primitive state. You've got the ghost fear concept stuff, but that's all, it's not as abstract as just some ism like we think of, because remember, it's tied to dreams. And the belief that has to be literal, and you must be somehow engaging ghost land, or spirit land. So it seems to have this, quasi-tangible validation to it, right? Keep going here.
The first step in enlightenment came with the belief that sex relations opened up the way for the impregnating ghost to enter the female. Man has since discovered that father and mother are equal contributors of the living inheritance factors which initiate offspring. But even in the 20th century, many parents still endeavor to keep their children in more or less ignorance as to the origin of human life.
Cabbage patches or storks or whatever, right? And so they're just reminding you there, like I was saying, don't forget how just slightly submerged your mentality like this is. It's so shallowly submerged that it actually still generates, you thinking you should come up with the stork story or something, That's what they're trying to get at between the lines there. And notice also how difficult it is once mankind has concluded, made a definite conclusion in some area, how difficult it is to fundamentally change that belief. It's not going to be changed overnight. It's going to evolve. So you're not just going to let go of what seems to be just way too proper, because it's a profound thought that spirits have something to do with it and all the mysteries of life and conception and babies and everything in the first place. It just seems like it has to be. So you're not going to let go of that easily. But you're starting to get a little suspicious, okay? I mean, see, your first cosmic intuition over the eons is like, you know, I'm getting the sense that there's some sort of causality thing here. I mean, the timing is just too coincidental all the time. I mean, you know, they said, you know, I'm pretty sure, you know, that harkens back to that time when we were together, and you know, and then I had to go off, you know, fighting, and we haven't really been together since, and you know, and it's like 9 months exactly, and you're getting suspicious that maybe you did have something to do with it, you know, as a man. And so like they say, you can see how they just produce that modified version. You aren't the direct causal agent, but you're the an indirect causal agent. That you're somehow potentializing, you know, the conception, but not actualizing the conception. So that's just the natural way we are with all these things. We evolve these ideas. You know, like I was.
All the birth control strategies, no sunlight, stay away from high tide. Spirits won't really know we were together.
Yeah, I mean. Sunscreen, you know, is a prophylactic.
you know, people like to, even primitive people like to think they're in control of their circumstances.
Yes, so yes.
That's how they, right. They're trying, their minds are trying to get control of the situation.
Yeah, see, and again, like I said, you don't underestimate, no matter how primitive and superstitious, they're still, by grace and circuited in the Holy Spirit, they have a first cosmic intuition. There's some vague notion of causality in play. Okay? It's going to have crude rationalizations, right, to play it out. But they're going to have this inescapable tendency to try to have some causality to it. Right? Like I pointed out, that's, you know, the magic man... You know, theory is at least causal, right? In concept, he acts, something happens, right? You know, that's why, you know, and that's primitive. You know, so to go to the magic matter hypothesis, like so-called enlightened modern man, right? I mean, that's pre-primitive. I mean, it doesn't have any causality to it. Right? Right? It just happens, right? With no sense of cause and effect. So, you know, there's magic, and then there's just, you know, ridiculous magical thoughts like that. It's really not the same modifier word magic and magic man and magic matter. Yeah, I mean, you ought to really come up with an even more ridiculous word instead of magic for magic matter. You know, it's just utterly absurd matter. Yeah. okay, so anyway, back to this. They've got, you know, they know she needs to be impregnated somehow. See, they've got that, you know, they have that sense. You know, even in the most primitive, you know, we didn't mention that. So you notice that, you know, they aren't just kind of thinking it's, you know, it's totally happening totally within her. They've got some notion that, you know, two things are coming together in some way to make it happen. All right, let's keep going here.
A family of some simple sort was ensured by the fact that the reproductive function entails the mother-child relationship. Mother love is instinctive. It did not originate in the mores as did marriage. All mammalian mother love is the inherent endowment of the adjutant mind spirits of the local universe and is in strength and devotion always directly proportional to the length of the helpless infancy of the species.
Yeah, so, you know, they're just reminding, you know, as women, you know, you don't just have, quote unquote, a maternal instinct. You have a very sophisticated manipulation of you going on, you know, where, you know, the mother's mind ministry has this all coordinated so that the strength of your instinct is correlated with just how helpless and for how long that infant is helpless. You aren't sort of responding to that, oh, I need to still have a maternal instinct because I can see it's still helpless. I mean, that's no thought required like that. You're just programmed to be kind of helplessly identified for the length that you need to be very focused so that the child makes it. It's very down there close to the mechanical, because again, it's a first adjutant. The first adjutant is really taking the lead here on this, just like the sex urge. Okay. I mean, sure, higher adjutants can be involved in this, but it's a very much rubber meet the road phenomenon we're talking about here. The first adjutant is very much in play, and that's why you can appreciate that it's not the first adjutant isn't just the energy of instinct, right? By grace of encirclement in the Holy Spirit, so those adjutants can be the spirit of something. With a woman, she has much more immediacy for that to be the spirit of intuition, than a man does. Having it be the spirit of intuition and not just the energy of instinct. Because the local universe mother is really taking a hold of human females to serve in her stead, where she can't be the womb, the material womb. She's making them very much not just a mind extension of herself, but a spirit extension of herself. It's a mind-spirit extension of herself to do her job appropriately without you having to really enter into it consciously at all. You're just, she's just going to basically puppet you, as it were, through the adjutant mind ministry to be a mother, in a basic biologic sense.
Yep. So, when you say helplessness, I mean, I see mothers doing this when their kids are in their 30s and 50s. Okay, so that instinct stays there.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, and we haven't quite gotten to, that playing out, but see, that's, this is the thing, the more kind of indelible, foundational an instinct is, the more you're inescapably going to have all good things taken to extreme become bad. Okay? It's very powerfully there because obviously in some very foundational sense, it's quote-unquote good, indispensable even. But you can overplay that. I mean, if you're nothing but your instincts, see, then you're never really a human. Like I said, I mean, at some point, like in this example we're talking about, a woman has to be something besides just a finger, as it were, of the local universe mother spirit. I mean, she has to be a separate and eventually independent individual, not just the local mom's deputy, right?
Kick the baby out of the nest.
Right. I mean, so... we all have to, whatever our basal instincts are, we have to challenge ourselves at some point to recognize, I understand why those were very important when I was, at a certain age or whatever, but I can't artificially drag that forward when I need to be bringing other considerations into play. There's more than just that. There's instinct. More than just my sex instinct. There's more than just my maternal instinct. I've got to bring other things into play to take control of those urges, even those impulses, if there's kind of a spiritized, energy to that urge, so it isn't just merely an urge. And this is just all good things taken to extreme become bad. And so when you can easily see a mother who's, a woman who's laboring, way down the road, the children are now, 40, 50 years old, and she's still struggling to not be really engaging them like they were one, and because she can't turn that off. There's no way to turn this off. There's no off switch on these instincts. But you just have to be able to say, okay, yes, but, okay, there's other considerations I have than just my maternal instinct here. But it's very, very difficult. In this life, perforce, you serve two masters. And men have to be very considerate of that, and women have to really challenge themselves in this regard. And then, like I said, flip it around to the other way. Men have instincts too that need to be brought under control. Well, like I just said, you don't have a paternal instinct, but you do have a sex urge. When you get a little further, they tell you, it's like, well, okay, if you have a maternal instinct, what's the parallel thing that's down at that foundational thing? And the revelers say, sex hunger. See, the woman, it's very difficult for the woman to have his deep down foundational a sex hunger, because maternal instinct occupies that foundational location. In a sense, she's got to kind of make room for it, But there's nothing to block it being right down there and foundational in a guy. So, those are those two foundational things. You have maternal instinct and sex hunger. And everyone knows how men, overplay the sex hunger way inappropriately. Certainly just as inappropriate as any woman has ever overplayed her maternal instinct.
One of the ways this plays out in society, when women were given suffrage,
mm-hmm.
The things that were important prior to that, the things that were important to men were the things they decided and voted upon.
Mm-hmm.
Once women had the vote, it opened up a whole new
vista of other things.
Worry about, and fix. And,
mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And of course, eventually it's supposed to be that complicated. And it's supposed to be just as challenging both directions. Men understanding that women have a place in civilizational structure and vice versa. To try to, even though you can't fully cross that divide, at least allow for the validity of what's on the other side of that divide, and do your best to allow, like you're saying, some way of equilibrating the system to take that into account. Yeah. Okay, let's see. Where did we get to? The helpless infancy. Anything else there? Oh, just one other little thing. Notice they are, again, challenging you to recognize that because there's levels of meaning, and up on the sixth level of meaning, there is the genuine fact of love. There are shadows cast by that fact down onto the lower levels, all the way down to the first level. So there's a validity in that hierarchical sense, using the word love, like sex love, down on the first level of meaning. But even more so, like I was pointing out, because of how, the difference in terms of the way the local universe mother spirit is engaging females in contrast to males, even more so, there's a top-down spiritizing, if you will, of a woman's mind all the way down to the foundational level. Like I said, so it's a spirit of intuition down there. And the validity to using the word love all the way down there for, what is just sort of in and of itself maternal instinct, okay? but you can call it mother love like they're doing there. See, with some validity.
This made me think of what causes that, because, you know, I've seen examples of both. You know, I've even seen what men do and exaggerate the importance of procreating, you know, and women, the importance of, you know, they got to be the mother to everyone. You see it with some people. I don't know if it's more common with women that don't actually have children, but they seem to take on these current issues that are going on with people coming from other countries are like children, you know, because
You're always going to, no matter what it is, see, whether it's an instinct like you're talking about or just some ideological frame, whatever frame you have, inescapably the natural thing is to bring some new stimulus and interpret it in that framework or deal with it within that framework. Well, this is like, you know, it's like I'm exposed to Christ, you know, coming here. You know, and I know about marriage, and so I think, well, oh, I can rationalize it like that. The relationship between Christ and the church is like marriage. See, that's, you have the pre-existing framework of marriage, the notion of marriage, and you just ingest this new stimulus and rationalize it in that existent frame. It's just what we do.
My point that I carried forward through this, I agree with that. You explained it good, but see, that's a doctrine. They get hung up on some kind of word doctrine.
Sure.
It's I call this sun consciousness. Maybe it's not totally correct. But they're not going to the Father. If they went all the way to the Father and just recalibrated, emptied themselves toward the Father and worship in that moment, I think they would be more in touch with the bottom intuition and say, wait a minute. It's not what I'm feeling.
Again,
you know? Even though I think that it's a moral thing, they're taking it up as a moral issue, and their morals may not, if they're not calibrating with the Father, like Jesus did, you know, it may not have objective validity.
Well, of course, right? I mean, again, that's just, you know, that's what we've talked about many times. I mean, those objective insights up there on those three levels of meaning in the upper domain, all of them can get polluted by bringing stuff in and lifting it up. So, you know, what you're saying is true. I mean, the only way to fundamentally reset that sort of pollution of your framework, where you've lifted something up and you aren't really genuinely dealing with it objectively, you have to get all the way up to the top and genuinely refound yourself. You have to be born again, see, you know, into a new frame.
Yeah.
You have to sort of reestablish that cosmic frame. Otherwise, that morality up there on the fifth level of meaning is just some social usage that's been brought in and put up there. It's just the mores, see. But again, don't you know? It's easier said than done. Don't ever forget how difficult it is to actually do that God the Father reset thing you were just talking about there, because you know that faith fact that resets it. The definition of the word faith can't be found in the dictionary, right? Humans struggle to transcend themselves, see, in a sense, and reinitiate that existential nucleus, you know, and take a hold of objective reality again. You know, they have a tendency to get almost up there, and all they do is end up juicing their subjective frame all the more and thinking of it as being objective all the more when it isn't. It's subjective. It's very problematic. I mean, I always refer to, you know, there's never been a more earnest seeker of that objective reset in all of human history than Descartes. Okay? He tried with all of his vast intellectual might, and he really couldn't get out of the old wineskin. When all was said and done, you know, it's very difficult. See, and see, technically it's impossible. That's why there's revelation. because it's impossible for us to bootstrap ourselves all the way up and reset like that to any effective degree. You need to just be told certain things and then discover a resonance that you have with those things by grace and go, yeah, that's it. That's the objective fact. I let go now. I can cleanly let go of what Descartes couldn't let go of, or what Augustine couldn't let go of, or whatever. And I'm going to reinitiate myself. I'm going to be really born again here. And I'm going to get out of the old wineskins. I'm going to see things. Behold, all things are becoming new now, you know, in my mind.
Chris, could it be, yeah. Can I take it one step further?
Yeah.
Could it be that, is it paper 9? Talks about it gives you a little snippet in there. There's two aspects of the personality, but that objective response to the Father's personality, sir, it's a response by us.
Yeah.
It's not, we recognize it. Could it be that it's our first impression? You know, people make a big deal. Psychologists used to at one time. Your first impression. What's your first impression of something? What's your first impression?
Yeah.
Now we can't politically say our first, correctly say our first impression. It might offend somebody. But we just skip over that. We skip over that into our interpretive mind. You think that might be it?
Sure,
because good. Even in the foreword, it says, you know, that...
Yeah. Again,
the will,
yeah, right. Not,
the will
no,
comes before the right. Will of God comes before our recognition of it.
Right. Yeah. You have to just get to that instinctual
yeah.
An intuitive foundation, not instinctual, intuitive foundation. Yes. But again, I'll just remind it, like I just said, don't underestimate how difficult that is in practice. It's easy to say in theory, but be very humble about how much you've achieved that in practice. You know, the Revelators are trying to remind us of it's easier said than done. So always be looking for yet higher, yet more objective, because maybe you've made some progress, but there's always room for a little more clarity, a little more enlightenment. Yeah. All right. Okay, let's keep going here.
The mother and child relation is natural, strong, and instinctive, and one which, therefore, constrained primitive women to submit to many strange conditions and to endure untold hardships. This compelling mother love is the handicapping emotion which has always placed woman at such a tremendous disadvantage in all her struggles with man. Even at that, maternal instinct in the human species is not overpowering. It may be thwarted by ambition, selfishness, and religious conviction.
Okay, so why is it that in humans, as opposed to other mammals, it's not overpowering? Because for a human, you don't just have, well, what's most foundational? Nothing can be more foundational than the most foundational thing. And so when all is said and done, that rules the day. See, that's all an animal has. Okay, but you have a top side to your mind that the animal doesn't have. Spirit is literally over, you know, your mind. And... see, it's only because you're encircled in the Holy Spirit and have a vantage point top down upon your mind that you can have ambition, selfishness, or religious conviction overrule the maternal instinct. It's because humans are spiritual that they can be like that. You know, see, and again, it's like, well, I don't know, I think of spiritual as just a positive word. It's like, well, no. It's fundamentally spiritual. When the Revelators say something is spiritual, what they mean is that you have superimposed an external influence on your mind, and your mind is functioning unnaturally. the mere mammal mom can't function unnaturally. All she can do is function naturally. But a human mother can function unnaturally, and she can, you know, like we were just talking earlier, eventually she has to take control of her maternal instinct, put it in the proper balance and proportion with everything else. I mean, well, what gives her the potential to do that? She's spiritual. She can do something that's unnatural. You know, so, but of course, it's a double-edged sword, that spiritual nature, that potentially unnatural. You know, in the same way that you could very helpfully put the maternal instinct in the proper balance and proportion with everything else, you can put all kinds of things way out of proportion. The first thing that you're always thinking of putting above everything else with your spiritual ability is yourself, the selfishness one there. You know, I'm going to put self-gratification above everything else because that's my religion. Yeah.
Sort of affected by the sheltered bay, that seemed like the sheltered bay kind of lowered the levels on this ambition, selfish
conviction stuff. Yeah. Yeah, like I've said so many times, see, the more we're not in that very primitive beginning womb of the sheltered bay, right, the more that we're, evolution is moving us out onto the high seas, the more spiritual we are naturally. See, just the more, you can't be just going with what's going to happen naturally. Selfishness is what happens naturally, you know, and spiritualized selfishness is not a positive thing, right? Right? Unspiritualized selfishness is egoism. Spiritualized selfishness is egotism, right? Egoism is good. If you take that good thing to an extreme, it becomes bad, and we actually have a separate word for it when it's taken to that unfortunate extreme, egotism. Yeah, so, that none of that unnatural sort of stuff can happen without you being spiritual.
Yeah. I got danger.
Right. Yeah, being spiritual means that you can wield yourself. Yourself isn't just a helpless victim of its natural estate. Okay, so, they give you those general terms like ambition, selfishness, and religious conviction because obviously there's a million and one specific variations, you know, under each of those umbrellas. Yeah, and that... you know, exactly how those play out. In what way are you ambitious, you know, et cetera. But again, to just back up away from that, right, I mean, this very unbalanced situation between these two foundational urges, the maternal instinct being the foundation in one, sex hunger being the foundation in the other, and how... The man is only bound to his sex hunger for a short span of time. But the woman, it's like, you know, she just can't get away from it. A man might come back around quite frequently to the sex hunger, you know, but there's a comeback around. You know, there's at least a moment of release from that. I mean, it's very difficult for the woman to turn away or be turned away from the maternal instinct. And so, you know, like they're pointing out, this is a handicapping situation. It just means there's no way she can kind of just smoothly strike step with a man, you know, and what's going on in the society. You know, there's always going to be this differential. Okay, so what else do they say about that?
While the mother-child association is neither marriage nor home, it was the nucleus from which both sprang. The great advance in the evolution of mating came when these temporary partnerships lasted long enough to rear the resultant offspring, for that was homemaking.
Okay, so there again, between the lines. It's a handicapping situation, but it's indispensable, right? You can't get civilization if you don't initiate civilization. Something has to initiate it, you know? And when I look to the females in the room, tag, you're it, right? You've been chosen by the cosmos to be the founder, the initiator, right, of civilization. The fundamental civilizing influence. The mother-child association is neither marriage nor home, but it was, the nucleus from which both sprang. Without that maternal instinct, nothing can happen. There's no way to get it started. So if you will, that's it. The consequences of that are a burden that you have to bear. The handicaps that you suffer, right, are for the greater good, is what they're talking about between the lines.
Supported by ambition, yeah. Selfishness, and religious conviction.
Yeah, everyone who knows this paper knows we're getting towards that paragraph that speaks to you very directly in that regard.
Or unless you can, all sorts of other reasons.
Right, and obviously, think about the guilt, like you're kind of pointing out, the guilt that can result if, for whatever circumstances, I think I've shrugged my duty, it's my duty, and then we're fraught with guilt, our animal nature guilt. If we think we aren't meeting our responsibilities, whatever they are, you then have that to deal with, to recognize that you haven't really gone rogue. This is just the vicissitudes of life. Sometimes things just don't work out. It's not going to be held against you eternally. Don't bring some false existentialization of animal guilt into play in your mind. But again, that's easier said than done. It's easy for me to just say that, but I know how difficult it is for me to deal with those guilts that we all have, that can be just imposed upon you by societal norms. Society expects you to do certain things, and if you don't do that, it's so difficult to not feel guilty. Feel that you aren't holding up your end of the bargain here in some way. What else do we have here? I'll just note that the great advance, just how they purposely use such a pregnant word like advance, like the advancing phase of civilization, that it's, it may be happening way back in the early stages of progressing civilization, but when that begins to happen, the celestials that are observing get excited. It's like, okay, I'm beginning to see the future in the present. It's pregnant with potential. For that was homemaking, right?
And there's a lot of present-day marriages last about that long.
Yeah.
And then look at each other.
Why are we doing
the kids
this?
Are gone.
Right. But see, even for them, it's like, well, okay, at least that was homemaking, right? You played your part, for civilization. Like I said, we have to avoid these tendencies to overplay all these things so that you bring unnecessary guilt into play. Remember they talked about that a bunch when they talked about the dissolution of of wedlock, you know, back there in the previous paper. Okay.
Regardless of the antagonisms of these early pairs, notwithstanding the looseness of the association, the chances for survival were greatly improved by these male-female partnerships. A man and a woman cooperating, even aside from family and offspring, are vastly superior in most ways to either two men or two women. This pairing of the sexes enhanced survival and was the very beginning of human society. The sex division of labor also made for comfort and increased happiness.
You know, there's a great paragraph. You know, we were talking about how we labor under all sorts of ideological impositions. Think about how few people on the planet could read that little passage there. A man and a woman cooperating, even aside from family and offspring, is vastly superior in most ways to either two men or two women, and not hear that as some sort of a harsh ideological statement. Your first challenge is that has absolutely nothing to do with ideology. That's just physics. Why is it physics? Because which is the greater differential? And hence, which is the greater potential? Right? Even when you pick two males or two females that are quite different, you never can achieve the differences, you know, when you actually bridge the divide between the two sexes. It's just fundamentally a greater divide, which means it's more difficult, obviously, to bring the two sides together. But the potential, if you can somehow, to some degree, bring those two remote differentials together and have a super additive consequence, right? It's super-er, right? Yeah. The greater the potential, the farther up the super additive consequence goes. Right? If you make the two facts infinite and infinitely separated, the super additive consequence is infinitely transcendent and also infinite. What's an example that you can think of that I have the deity absolute on one side, the unqualified absolute on the other side, both each infinite and they're infinitely separated. I get a super additive consequence of the universal absolute that's infinitely transcendent and infinite itself. So it's just innate in the physics. The more you pull them apart, the more you're powering it up where they can, where the super additive consequence can leap all the higher. And so, and you can see how they're saying it, it's not in every way, in most ways. And also just, there are some very stark differences between two females or two males. They're clear on the far ends of the bell curve, of that sex. But obviously, if nothing else, just statistically, if you want to say, or in general, right, the centers of the bell curves of the two sexes are definitively separated. And that just, when all is said and done, there's more potential there. That's what they're talking about. It's just the physics of it.
Also, too, what makes me think is the more brought to home, Andon and Fonta, and when they, how long Andon was trying to spark to get a fire.
Concept.
But he had a mate that was, they were similar enough. Well, they were the first two humans, so they weren't animals
anymore. Yeah.
And after a few months, she brought in a nest. And just because of her more womb-like mind, maybe, as opposed to his more, direction-like mind, he's sparking and he's not getting anything. She brings in the nest and waboom.
Yeah, know, yeah. See, just yeah. I mean, if nothing else, just the fact that males and females, you know, have this general separation of perspective. You know, the one can think of something more naturally that the other doesn't. You know, and it can be just something very trivial. It doesn't have to be that profound, but just, oh, I never thought of that. That's a great idea. You know, in retrospect, you go, well, you know, I could have thought of that. See, it's not that you couldn't have. Again, it's just, it's very difficult to function unnaturally. See, you could have, if you had functioned more unnaturally, you could have thought of that. But see, most of the time we aren't. We're just kind of in a very natural mode. And it's very handy to have an otherness of naturalness in play. You know, that just naturally will bring in another, come at things from a different angle. So.
Yeah, that's so fun. I mean, direction,
yeah.
Sparking, you know, yeah. I'm going to conquer this, I'm going to get it, I'm going to work harder and do it more.
Yeah.
And she's thinking more of a thing, a place, you know, more of a static kind of thing, mm-hmm. a nest.
Yeah. Spark and rest.
Yeah.
See, that's so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Right. John's point, see, it's just, yeah, notice that was almost instantaneously, it was one of the very first things they did, where they discovered exactly what they're talking about here. Regardless of the antagonisms of these early pairs, notwithstanding the looseness of the association, the chances of survival were greatly improved by these male-female partnerships. They didn't freeze to death as they headed north. Right? Yeah.
Most of the early trappers and mountain men, when they came out west, took Indian wives.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Probably couldn't have survived the winter if they hadn't.
Yeah, and there's just so many things that go beyond sex hunger. That's what they're trying to get us to remember here. This isn't just a sex hunger issue that we pair up like this. It just works better, you know? And when you fail to be humble enough to acknowledge that, that's a sad thing for you. And you can't acknowledge the significance of the other. Okay, and then they notice how they end it there. The sex division of labor also made for comfort and increased happiness. I hope I'm not, you know, harping on this too much, but every time that they use the word happiness, pause and remind yourself of how unnatural that word, you know, what an unnatural state of affairs that word is referring to. And so, you know, you always have to think about it a little bit. There's nothing immediate about interpreting a sentence that has the word happy in it. It's like, well, okay, wait a minute. It seems like they're saying that it's all just more natural, but happiness is not a natural word. What do they mean? A lot of times when they're talking about kind of primitive circumstances, very immediate circumstances, when they use the word happy, they're reminding you that, again, happiness is, again, a lot easier said than done. We talk about big divides and how much potential there is there. Yeah, but the difficulty of actually bringing two remote things together, right? I mean, if you have a very, very difficult environment, it's very, very difficult for you to overcome that and have a positive response to that negative stimulus. If you can turn the volume down a little bit on the negative stimulus, if you can mitigate that negativity a little bit so that it isn't so harsh, it's easier to have a positive response to such a lessened negative stimulus. That's what they mean here. Okay. It just is like, okay, I can deal with that harshness. But man, I try to imagine, how could I ever be happy, you know, without this help to mitigate, right, the severity of the harshness.
And you have to dismiss comfort there. That's
mortifying. Yes, yeah. Good point. There's just me kind of fixating on the word happiness. But yeah, don't forget about the strength, you know, to the fort root there, you know, that you're with strength there. Yes. You know, see, so it, that's just, you know, again, the spiritual nature of genuine happiness, the personal nature of genuine happiness, you know, that fort root there, that strength is spiritual strength. And you're with the come prefix, you're with that strength. Right? This, like the strength to have a positive response to a negative stimulus. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Makes sense how they brought that together.
Right. Exactly. You know, the comforter, of the spirit of truth. See, it's catalyzing spiritual strength. It's not a salve, right? It's not the opiate of the masses. Okay. Yep.
Again, from drawing from the forward here, realizes the Father realizes he enjoys. I'm just looking at the verbs. It's another threefold thing. And achieves. Uh-huh. You know. Maybe that's the Father realizes, the Son gives that enjoyment, you know, the realization, divinely fraternal.
Yeah.
And
the God of action achieves,
super
yeah.
Super additive is achievement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
so, yeah. You know, maybe it can be applied to Andon and Fonta too. You know, that sparking is the realization. He's got a realization. And then she just kind of steps back.
You can always reflect on the patterns and how universal they are and how delightful that is. You know, that, like I say so many times, if you begin to put the pattern together in some area, it's wonderful to begin to take that to other areas that you didn't even remotely have in mind. When you figured it out there, it's like, oh, that's the same pattern there. Now I can understand that. Yeah. Okay, let's get a little bit about, so we start with this very immediate maternal instinct founding fact. Obvious consequence of that, the woman is going to have a very elevated position in everyone's mind here, you know, especially if you've don't think the man has anything to do with procreation. You know, it's not surprising that you might start out with the mother family. Okay.
Section 2, the early mother family. The woman's periodic hemorrhage and her further loss of blood at childbirth early suggested blood as the creator of the child, even as the seat of the soul, and gave origin to the blood bond concept of human relationships. In early times, all descent was reckoned in the female line, that being the only part of inheritance which was at all certain.
Right, like I said, it's just like nothing else that humans could do. I mean, it's just inescapable corollary here, that you're going to have matriarchy to begin with. Mm-hmm. And notice again, like as we were pointing out, just how foundational, innately, the female is here. Even that whole, you know, the extensive elaboration on the notion of blood that humans have had in all kinds of different, you know, aspects of their mori systems and stuff and beliefs, you know, reminding you that all kind of is founded in just how much blood is involved in the fact of a female, you know, and her nuclear role in founding civilization here. So it's just kind of inescapable that you even have the concept of bloodlines. You know, you just talked about the female line there and that those are bloodlines. See, that's because they're pointing out just what everyone was aware of about the natural state of females. There's always blood. So it just, and I mean, and that is so, so foundational. Did the revelators break from that? When they started coining words? No. Sangic. Sang. Right? Blood. Right? I mean, because, You know, that literally means bloodline producing, right? The book is constructed in evolutional fashion, not revolutional fashion. You know, just the way they coin words, right? That's so they're just reminding you of why they coined that word the way they did, right? With a fun little tweak to the IK suffix. That's a, you know, when you talk about Indo-European, you know, so Andite sort of root suffixes or elements of a word. You know, where are Andan and Fanta and the Sangiks and everything, where are they located? Is that more the Indo or the European part of Indo-European? It's obviously the more Indo, right, part. It's over there towards India. You know, so is that a you know, a Germanic-like suffix? No, it's Sanskrit. Yeah. Right, that IK is, you know, is a you know, they're drawing that from Sanskrit side of Indo-European. Just see to give a little tip of the hat to where that was all starting there in Central Asia.
Precision.
Yeah, just you gotta love it. Okay, anyway, there's the blood issue being founded, okay.
The primitive family, growing out of the instinctive biologic blood bond of mother and child, was inevitably a mother family, and many tribes long held to this arrangement. The mother family was the only possible transition from the stage of group marriage in the horde to the later and improved home life of the polygamous and monogamous father families. The mother family was natural and biologic. The father family is social, economic, and political. The persistence of the mother family among the North American red men is one of the chief reasons why the otherwise progressive Iroquois never became a real state.
We'll pick up that last little thing in a second here, but all right, like I was just saying, you know, they said inevitably a mother family, right? It's just there's, and then they doubled down. The mother family was the only possible transition from the stage of group marriage in the horde, you know, to subsequent facts. So this is on every inhabited world. I mean, they all start out in the horde. Every inhabited world goes through this transition. And they're reminding you of, again, the sequence of this transition. It's going from wholly natural to budding unnatural. The mother family is natural, so it's first. And when you start to get a little bit more human, not just fancy animal modality in play, you're inexorably going to move to that beginning unnaturalness of the father family. See, and how you have to recognize that, you know, against our current indoctrination, natural good, unnatural bad. Right, so therefore, mother family good, father family bad. All the more reason to have our institutions of higher learning demonizing patriarchy. Okay, again, it's all good things taken to extreme become bad. You can take the goodness of patriarchy and what they're in this evolutionary sense and overplay that, and it becomes bad. Well, just because you can overplay it and make it bad doesn't mean it's totally bad. You know, it in two different ways. Something can be good as long as, you know, for a long span of evolution, as long as you don't overplay it. So maybe it's just that simple issue that it's being overplayed. Or, you know, the goodness of it is temporally circumscribed. Right, there's a certain stage in the evolutionary process where it's the only way and it's good. But then you just move beyond that, and even in any lesser degree, it's not good anymore. You know, so you have to figure out which it is. Some things are good, you know, over almost the whole span of human history, from beginning to light and life. Other things, it's just a very short scaffolding stage. And during that scaffolding stage, that's, you know, whatever it is good. And like I said, it may be just, you know, just literally indispensable. You know, there is no other way from point A to point B except through that, you know, that state. Yeah, you have something? Okay. Now the little thing they're throwing in there about the goodness, if you will, of this is, remember we talked about this whole evolution starting with the horde in terms of civilization just proper, where you go, you know, you get families, and you get clans, and you get tribes, and you get nations, and finally territorial states. See, they mentioned the Iroquois never became a real state. You can recall, they already touched on this way back there at the beginning of the development of the state paper, paper 71, when they said that their nearest approach, you know, talking about Amerinds, their nearest approach was the Iroquois Federation, but this group of six nations, see, so you got that problem that they, you know, haven't really gotten to just one nation, but this group of six nations never quite functioned as a state and failed to survive because of the absence of certain essentials of modern national life, such as, and they give you a whole list, you know, and one of them is practical family organization. These red men clung to the mother family and nephew inheritance. You know, that might be the first thing you start thinking about. Like, okay, if I have a mother family, how does this whole, you know, lines of descent thing work? And that's just like, whoa. Okay, it's not the simple thing. It doesn't just like go from mother to daughter to daughter to, like it goes from father to son to son. Nephew inheritance. This sounds really complicated. You know, and they're about to mention this. It is. It's very complicated and quickly becomes impractical. You know, say practical family organization is the way they described that there. It just becomes way, you know, no one can keep track of what's going on, and there's too many chefs in the kitchen. Okay, and it just doesn't work. You know, it's like trying to win a war where you're being led by a committee. Remember that whole thing and how they discovered, no, the chief, you need a single, you know, chief, war chief. Okay, so they're bringing, you know, we've seen this a number of times where they hearken back to things they've mentioned in our civilizational a block of papers.
That could be what caused them to get into so many fights.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Destroying each other.
In this very next paragraph you're about to see, yeah, the whole, it's like, oh my goodness, there's going to be so many fights, so much tension. You know, look what they say here.
Under the mother family mores, the wife's mother enjoyed virtually supreme authority in the home. Even the wife's brothers and their sons were more active in family supervision than was the husband. Fathers were often renamed after their own children.
Instead of the other way around, where the children are named after their fathers, you know, so-and-so, the third, the fourth, the, yeah.
Father of.
Yeah, or Joshua ben Joseph, right? So step one, the matriarch is not the wife. In this matriarchy, yeah, it's her mom. Okay, so everyone should be like, oh my gosh, you know, just that is going to make complication, because there's never any issues between a mother and a daughter. You know, so already your mind is just reeling. And then it's like even the wives' brothers and their sons? Okay. We're more active in family supervision than was the husband. It's like, okay, this is just insanely too complicated. It's like, well, why on earth would, you know, okay, I can understand why mother family would be the natural thing because of what we just talked about. Okay, but why would it naturally be this complicated? Again, is there going to be this simple linear directional sort of a thing? You know, no, it's going to be this circle. Right, it's going to be this place-like mentality. And everyone in the circle is all has a role in this. You know, it only takes one point to make a ray, to make a line with an arrow ahead on it, right? Okay. But it takes a lot of points to fill out a circle. It's just inescapable. When you think, you know, when you put place in the lead like this, everyone in that place is going to be involved in, you know, there's way too many cooks in the kitchen. Yeah. See, so it's obvious this is just not going to, you know, the moment there's any external pressure applied to this, you know, who's going to have the social evolution, you know, advantage here, survival of the fittest? A mother family or a father family, right? You know, which of the two combatants are going to win? The warriors being led by a committee or the warriors being led by one guy on a white steed? Yeah. I mean, so, you know, it's obvious this is not going to work long term. But as they pointed out, every planet goes through this because it's just inescapable that you start with all this complexity. And, you know, one of the very reasons why there's progress on every world is because you start out with what's natural and eventually it gets so complicated and so prickly, you know, so painful. It's like, there's got to be a better way, right? You know, it's exactly like the material comfort era, like we've talked about. That's the one of in the big picture. That's the whole point of the material comfort era, is for all of those negative things to manifest to such insane degrees that basically everyone can go, there's got to be a better way. Okay, I mean the immediacy of the lights of greed and gluttony and drunkenness and tyranny and all this. That's the whole point, to create that tension, that conflict with your higher instincts that gets you to look for some way to take a step forward, to try, you know, initially it's not even how can I take a step forward, it's just how can I get out of this place I'm in? How can I, you know, there has to be some other way. Now, I hope maybe the other way is forward, but at this point, it's so painful. I'll go in any direction. Just give me other of any flavor.
This says eject. Let's do that.
Yeah. I don't care if my plane is upside down. I'm going to hit the eject button. You know? Like we've talked about so many times, that is what powers progress in the early evolutionary process. It's just... because no one is reflecting that much. And so it's just cattle prods. It has to be cattle prods. That's the only thing that moves things forward.
Well, this mother-in-law business has some deep roots, doesn't it?
Yeah, so you can imagine how this would become sort of mythologized even, see, you know, as people remember back. Remember when? Yeah. The person that ruled the roost was, yeah. Yeah, so you can just see how that became, you know, a cliche part of our tradition. Yeah.
It's not lost on the moderns.
Right? Yeah.
So okay. Take this
about
the complicatedness.
Yeah.
So the husband, let's say, is now, if he has a sister or two sisters, he's now doing more to raise their families because of what we're saying here, that
yep,
wisdom
yep,
is his own.
Yep.
So you can see how complicated it
is. I know, it's just,
in order it didn't work.
It's insane. It's just, yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's like, I mean, how could you, yeah, I mean, how could anything ever go anywhere in this state? I mean, you're so wrapped around the axle every direction, like you're saying. You know, I've got 12 sisters. Ah, you know, it's like, you know, it's just, it's ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah, but your mother-in-law or whatever is ruling the roost about everything.
Yeah.
In every family?
Oh, that's just harsh.
Yeah, I know. It's just so harsh. It's just so incomprehensible.
No, it's a whole mess.
I mean, oh my goodness gracious. You know, it just, you know, it's like, gee, I wonder why the whole romantic thing wasn't happening back then. It's like, where in the world would romance, you know, flower in the midst of this? Nowhere. I mean, there's just no place for it to even remotely be. Yeah.
Unless they're unfortunate and just found themselves destitute out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah. But then, of course, the problem is the marauding hordes, you know, would most likely take you out. Remember, we quickly discovered there was no way to survive just two people out in the middle of nowhere. You needed a group in order to stay alive.
This is why it took a whole village to raise a child.
Yeah, because it took that many people to hold spears, you know, to stay alive. Yeah. Okay.
The earliest races gave little credit to the father, looking upon the child as coming altogether from the mother. They believed the children resembled the father as a result of association, or that they were marked in this manner because the mother desired them to look like the father. Later on, when the switch came from the mother family to the father family, the father took all credit for the child, and many of the taboos on a pregnant woman were subsequently extended to include her husband. The prospective father ceased work as the time of delivery approached, and at childbirth he went to bed along with the wife, remaining at rest from 3 to 8 days. The wife might arise the next day and engage in hard labor, but the husband remained in bed to receive congratulations. This was all a part of the early mores designed to establish the father's right to the child.
Yeah, so that last little bit is reminding me, it started out, okay, I mean, there has to be some way that this is sort of definitively juxtaposed and everyone gets it. This is connected to that. Okay, but, you know, we immediately see, oh, I could take advantage of this situation. And so, like they pointed out, you know, it immediately had a tendency to overswing to the other side. You know, and like they were saying there, where was that? He took all credit for the child. Okay, initially he had no relationship, and the next thing, you know, she has nothing to do with it. So we all know how the pendulum tends to swing to the complete opposite rail like that.
You know, there was none of this man getting completely frustrated with the situation and then just taking charge. No, man didn't take charge of anything. This was imposed by the mores.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and you can just see, so it's just interesting to, you know, like we were saying, to see how some of these things came into existence and then what we've done with them once they came into existence and how we've rationalized and re-rationalized and whatnot, you know, subsequently. But it seldom comes into existence the way you would think, you know, various things in our mores. You know, we look at them and go, well, it looks like it's a completely selfish or whatnot thing. Well, that's just the way we're currently rationalizing. It didn't start out that way. Very, very seldom. And then you got to love the, you know, you chuckle at the whole thing. They believe that the children resemble the father as a result of association or that they were, quote-unquote, marked in this manner because the manner desired them to look like the Father? You go, well, wow. I mean, we are so beyond thinking like that. No, as soon as we started thinking about evolution again in the 19th century, what was our initial notions? You may, for those who are familiar with that, well, I see, how did the giraffe get a long neck? I think it's just by association with tall trees, you know, and that the more it stayed associated with a tall tree, the more it started to be tall like a tree. All right, it's just right here, right? It resembled the Father as a result of associations. These are very ancient rationalization modes that just got reworked in that context. You know, and then we had it. It's like, no, that's not the way it works. They don't, you know, it's genetic, as Darwin, you know, put forward.
That sounds like what you just said before, Lamarckian evolution.
Yeah, see, Lamarckian, and you go, marked. They were marked, quote unquote. See? Yeah, I was about to point out the little pun between the lines there. Yes.
Kind of like the chief reason among the rednecks.
Yeah. That was rich too, right? Yeah. Yes, they love to throw in these puns. You know, some of them are really deep esoteric inside jokes, you know. You gotta really know your stuff to pick up on the pun.
Yeah.
Yep.
Chris Jean mentioned earlier a little bit ago that nobody took charge, like, you know. But that doesn't mean it wouldn't be appropriate at our level of evolution to have somebody take charge like that.
Right. See, you know, again, notice how we're struggling with leadership again. Because, see, we're kind of slipping back into the natural state where there are, you know, where we didn't have the notion of leaders. You know, there wasn't a chief or anything, you know.
You just
had this space and everyone was just kind of rattling around in it, you know. Nothing was going anywhere. There was no directionality to the phenomenon. Yeah, so we're falling back in that. Again, that whole... almost everything about direction itself is unnatural. I mean, think about this in an evolutionary context. You don't have seven sanguic races. You have six sanguic races. Right? You don't have an evolutionary race that favors the seventh adjutant. A race that favors the seventh adjutant, the directional one, in contrast to the six place-like ones, is unnatural. It's imported from the local system headquarters world. See, I mean, direction itself is kind of just inherently unnatural. You know, in the higher sense, like we were talking about spiritual, you know, your mind being directed, right? That's the spirit above the mind directing the mind. It's unnatural. What's directing it is unnatural to the mind. It's not part of the mind. It's above the mind, being superimposed upon the mind. Just, you know, and then, you know, even in the most, and then go all the way to the most transcendent sense of your personality influence. Again, see, it's so unnatural in the big picture. It has nothing to do with evolutionary, you know, experiential deity. It comes from existential deity. See? I mean, it's that unnatural, you know, if you're thinking of natural as being experiential or evolutionary. See, again, direction. See, that's just the more we become more natural, the more direction will disappear, the more we'll be suspicious of direction, you know, even, you know. Like, oh, no one should be taking, you know, definitive leadership and telling people what to do. See, it's that natural voice kind of rising to the surface again. And remember, Lucifer knows this, and he played into that. So yeah, that whole unnatural direction coming from somewhere else and imposing upon you, you know, you just tell them they're not the boss of you.
Foreign potent.
you know, foreign potentates or whatever. See, he's play. It's a sophistry. See, he's playing into your natural tendencies. You go, yeah, right? Natural. That's what it's supposed to be. We can't let ourselves fall into that natural frame. The whole point of getting to light and life, like I stress all the time, when you finally get fully into light and life, everything is now unnatural. That's the whole point. You start with everything natural, and you end up with everything unnatural. Just like, is there anything about an architectural sphere that's natural? No! It doesn't form naturally or anything. It's 100% unnatural.
When you get to paradise,
that's the whole point.
When you get to paradise, all motion is volition. Yeah, all motion is volition.
Right. See, it's all an art form, right? See, it's all unnatural. That's the whole point, you know. And that's why I stress this so much. I mean, it is this insanely insidious doctrine that we've all adopted about the most sacred thing, or whatever, is naturalness. It's just exactly the opposite. But there is beauty to it. See, again, it's not a dichotomy. It's the only possible beginning. So it's sacred in that sense as a beginning, but it's not your destiny. The universe's destiny is to be personality managed, every single automaton. See, personality managed. That's the destiny. It's not the origin or most of the history, but it's definitely the destiny. And that's the challenge. Appreciate nature as the grace, see, of a beginning. You know, it's not just natural. It's coincidentally a natural that allows for you to go forward from that, and isn't sort of an inescapable end in itself, an insidious conspiracy of containment and confinement and it's short-circuiting. No, it's not that kind of a natural. It's what natural is potential, waiting to be artfully actualized, yeah, to be mastered. Your natural mind is waiting for you to do something unnatural with it, and its naturalness is such that something can be done with it. It's not a naturalness where there's no handles, there's no way to get a hold of it, there's nothing you can do with it. Right? It just is what it is.
Thought changer, thought adjuster, thought controller.
Yeah, right. Okay, let's get some more here.
At first, it was the custom for the man to go to his wife's people. But in later times, after a man had paid or worked out the bride price, he could take his wife and children back to his own people. The transition from the mother family to the father family explains the otherwise meaningless prohibitions of some types of cousin marriages, while others of equal kinship are approved.
See, just without, you know, trying to get into the detail, you know, we were already talking about the whole thing with, you know, like nephew inheritance and all these stuff. So obviously with all of that complexity, there could be all sorts of taboos about who gets married to whom and whatnot to try to, you know, keep this complicated system all in play. And so when you make this transition, you've got all the baggage of that stuff being carried forward, you know, even though it might be completely, you know, arbitrary, you know, in the subsequent father family modality, it nonetheless is hard to let go of those things once you get them started. So you get these non sequiturs, you know, in the Moray system. And notice again, they're pointing out the evolution of here from place to direction dominated, and there's kind of transitions. You know, initially, okay, you've got kind of the beginnings of a father family, but he's still having to go over to her place and just stay there. So it's kind of only quasi-directionized, this whole phenomenon. But see, eventually, it's like, okay, you may have to go over there, you know, at least long enough to pay for the bride. You know, you might have to do the thing where, well, if you work for me for 7 years, okay, then you can marry her, you know, like we talked about before. But eventually, he can go off in his own direction. He isn't bound to that place. So, but it didn't happen overnight. It was an evolution. All right, keep going.
With the passing of the hunter mores, when herding gave man control of the chief food supply, the mother family came to a speedy end. It failed simply because it could not successfully compete with the newer father family. Power lodged with the male relatives of the mother could not compete with power concentrated in the husband father. Woman was not equal to the combined tasks of childbearing and exercising continuous authority and increasing domestic power. The oncoming of wife stealing and later wife purchase hastened the passing of the mother family.
Yeah, so again, they already talked about those issues, so obviously that, you know, starts to blow up the whole mother family concept when those things come into play. But again, it just reminds you of how far back you have to go to have mother families, you know, universally. Because, you know, everyone knows that things like, you know, wife stealing and wife purchase, that goes back pretty far. So, you know, you got to go back even further.
I don't know, it happens today in a different way.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like we said, these things, yeah, always tend to hang on in various modes. You're correct, yes. You know, they'll get more into that whole issue of once you get to herder, you know, how things, you know, really flip signs and get into the mode that everyone's familiar with, say, in the Old Testament or whatnot, you know, because of those pastoral peoples, you know, where, you know, women are struggling to be seen to have any value at all. You know, it's like, so the pendulum, you know, they go from everything to almost nothing in the Moray system. And, you know, it's just a very extreme flip, you know, as we all know. And now we're having to, you know, to try to, you know, find the equity in the middle. Because we've definitely scoped out the boundaries over human history. Let's see. And just the other little thing I already kind of mentioned, but notice they pointed out directly. Power lodged in the male relatives of the mother could not compete with power concentrated in the husband father. That's just the exact, you know, family analog to what was happening in the whole in the tribe in general, where the war party led by a committee, you know, could not compete with the war party led by a war chief. Yeah. You know, so often you have sort of the macroscopic and the microscopic in the society like this. It's the exact same thing, one, you know, for the whole group and the other at the nuclear family level. Exact same thing that was playing out.
Even when the mother family held sway, it was the mother-in-law, or the effectively mm-hmm. the grandmother who right. had exercised the power. Mm-hmm. She didn't have the immediate
yeah.
children running around under her feet.
Yeah, like they were pointing out. And she could. It was easier for her to overrule some of the maternal instinct than it was for the actual wife. Yeah, so that she could rule the, you know, archy part of matriarchy, right? You know, like they were saying, that increasing domestic power thing there is just too much when you're the literal mom of the family.
There's something else in this that's kind of hidden is if the home and family becoming more significant,
mm-hmm.
there's a power element there. that's growing.
Yep. Yeah. Power is getting, individuated. You know, it starts out in a very diffuse, amorphous fashion, and it begins to coalesce, you know, and individuate. And like I said, so then it can be directed. It's no longer this amorphous phenomenon, but it crystallizes into something that can be definitively directed. And see, and again, until you have direction, how could there be progress? See, yeah. I mean, progress kind of, you immediately visualize that as an arrow with an arrowhead on it, right? I mean, you know, progress isn't visualized as a circle. So, yeah, all this is inescapably has to play out this way if civilization is going to progress.
Chris, just the dimensions of paradise itself being 1/6 longer in the north-south direction as opposed to the... If it didn't have that 1/6 longer in that direction, it would be a perfect circle. It would be perfectly balanced. There would be nothing to offset the circle. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So,
I mean,
so it's like, you know, 1/6 more emphasis on the directional as opposed to the...
Don't go that far with it, but just recognize, right. I mean, you know, yeah, why isn't paradise a perfect sphere? First it's flattened. You know, but then it's not a circular pancake; it's an elliptical pancake. You know, why are all three dimensions different? Because if you didn't, there wouldn't be the x direction, the y direction, the z direction. You have to break the symmetry of a sphere just to inject that foundational directionality of three dimensions. See,
yeah.
Into existence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there, you know, that, see, it's a place. It's, you know, it's obviously, you know, it's the geographic center of infinity. Okay. You know, it's definitely this nuclear place-like fact, the isle. But, see, it has the beginnings of directionizing in the fact that it's the symmetry of the sphere is broken. Okay. All right. Let's see. I guess we just have the final little bit here, don't we? Yep.
The stupendous change from the mother family to the father family is one of the most radical and complete right-about-face adjustments ever executed by the human race. This change led at once to greater social expression and increased family adventure.
Yeah, everyone's got a chuckle about that one. Who's driving the station wagon?
But we
already saw this several times. I was like, whoa, that's 180 degrees. And like I said, this is, you know, and it's very sweeping, and because it's a foundational fact, it impacts everything. So it's the most radical and complete right about face, 180 degree turn. Right? So very much so. And then again, that last sentence, you know, that we're chuckling about there at the beginning. This change led at once. You know, in other words, there must be something pretty natural about this, as it were, to greater social expression and increased family adventure. Yeah, you went from place to direction. So again, I mean, it's natural for a man to be directional, but it just kind of reminds you of how unnatural a man is to begin with. When you're developing in the womb, does it start out man?
No.
Yeah. See, it unnaturally flips to male as it develops. Like I said, that directionizing, you know, everything about it, high, low, and everything in between, should remind you of some sort of from without father influence, right? You know, the functioning of father deity, right, that does two things. Right? What is fathering? It's initiating and directing, right? You have that from without, that unnatural superimposition of directionizing, right, into the natural just placeness of deity within, the immanence of deity, the mother. Okay. He's the will, she's the way. But, you know, again, greater social expression. Until there's some directionality, nothing's getting expressed. It's all just locked, hidden inside of a circle, right? There's just no way for something to manifest until there's a directionizing of it. So social expression, and then just, you know, let's see where this road goes, right? I mean, increased family adventure, just, you know, the directionality of wanting to just head towards the horizon or whatever. Yeah, so it's just immediate. Okay, so they're ready now. When we pick it up next time, when they start talking about the Father family, you know, we're obviously leaving behind this whole sort of beginning primitive stage, and kind of immediately you're talking about stuff that everyone has a familiarity with, you know, now that you've flipped everything like this to an unnatural state that you're basically, you know, imposing upon yourself by the mores, all of the tensions, you know, as soon as it's not natural, there's going to be all kinds of tensions that aren't there naturally that you're going to have to deal with. The fundamental difference between men and women, you know, is going to be there. And so obviously that's what we'll start to talk about very definitively next time. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.